Each year, 40 million students graduate high school and make what many consider the most important decision of one's entire life: where to attend college. Anxious about their future, pressured by their parents, and armed with only the most basic understanding of compound interest, would-be college freshmen make the kind of customer most businesses only dream of. An 18-year-old is more informed about the brand of shoes they wear than the institution at which they'll spend 200 weeks of their lives and $84,000 on average. It's not their fault. The basic problem is information asymmetry. Prospective students can take tours, deciding whether a school's trees are a satisfactory shade of green and buildings sufficiently old-looking, but nearly everything else they know comes from just one source: the seller. Now imagine making this decision 7,000 miles away, having never stepped foot in the country and as a non-native English speaker. That's the challenge faced by America's 340,000 Chinese international students. So, what does a diligent young adult do to compensate? They turn to the Consumer Reports of Education, college rankings. But for this prudence, little do they know, they're rewarded with a mix of fraud and deception. It's not just that rankings are inaccurate or misleading, though make no mistake, they are. The real problem is much, much deeper. In fact, almost everything wrong with higher education today, the student loan crisis, inequitable admissions, academic plagiarism, and the collapse of tenure, are ultimately symptoms. Symptoms of one giant interconnected web of deceit. Sponsored by Fabulous, the app that uses behavioral science to help you build healthy habits like meditation, exercise, and better sleep. From the day a baby is born in China, he or she unknowingly enters a race. Although they won't take the Gaokao, China's college entrance exam, for another 18 years, it alone will ultimately determine their career and social class. And determine means determine. There are no letters of recommendation, extracurriculars, awards, or alternate pathways. The Gaokao is the only race that matters. Because it's held just once a year and the results highly publicized, the cost of failure is enormous. Every hour of sleep lost, every hobby forgone, and talent abandoned is easily justified. It could be the difference between one's dream and fallback. Why do Chinese students collectively sacrifice what the rest of the world calls adolescence for a single exam? In a word, fairness. The poor farmer's daughter and chief executive's son take the same exam in the same room at the same time. Of course, in the real world, the rich and powerful usually find a way. Contradictions, after all, have never stopped China, a communist country with the second highest concentration of billionaires. For middle and upper class kids, an overseas education is a lifeboat on the Titanic, an escape from academic pressure and the public spotlight, respectively. Hong Kong chief executive Carrie Lam's son and chairman Xi Jinping's daughter both attended Harvard. Now, hold that thought for a moment. 7 in 10 Americans attend a public college. But despite coughing up over $21,000 a year for in-state tuition, room, and board on average, students themselves only directly contribute 1/5 of their school's budget. Most of the total, about 40%, is covered by state, federal, and a bit of local government grants, contracts, and appropriations. What this means is that public universities are largely at the whim of their federal and state governments, who in turn depend on a healthy stream of tax revenue. During normal times, which is to say a long time ago, this was no big deal. The system, imperfect as it was, chugged along mostly fine enough until the 2008 recession, when schools were painfully reminded of the house of cards they're built upon. People lost their jobs, the government lost its tax revenue, and thus universities lost their funding. Oops. Not only was there just less money going around, but because there was less money going around, universities were under greater scrutiny to use it well. Less money, yet more demands. So what did they do? What every good capitalist does, of course. They commodified education, casting their line further and further afield in search of untapped markets. They both exported the product, slapping their logos on deep-pocketed modular architecture everywhere, and imported customers. International students weren't some new invention, but universities were shocked by how deep the wells were, particularly in China. It all began as a short-term solution to an acute problem: fill a hole in the budget. But they soon realized the potential. The intense pressure of the Gaokao, combined with China's growing middle class, had produced an insatiable desire for overseas credentials. Today, there are 2.5 times as many Chinese international students in the US as second place India, which is itself 2.7 times larger than third place Korea. And that's not just because China is huge. The country is home to 18% of the world's population, but 35% of international students in America. Demand, in other words, had accidentally discovered a huge underexploited supply. There was basically no limit to the number of keen Chinese students they could attract. Even a decent state school in the middle of nowhere could arbitrage the American brand, converting its US address plus the vague notion of international exposure into cold, hard cash. But say you're a Chinese student who's never stepped foot in the States. How do you pick a school despite knowing next to nothing about the country, much less any individual city or state? You take out your phone, Google best colleges in America, and tap on the first result. Duh. Enter college rankings. Students and their parents are universally desperate for objective answers, guidance in making the quote right choice, and later assurance that they indeed have. Rankings prey on this anxiety, and doubly so in the case of international students, whose vacuum of knowledge is ripe for exploitation. Chinese international students, in particular, are both by far the largest kind, and according to this survey, the most persuaded by reputation and prestige. The only little problem is that rankings are, well, complete and utter garbage. Let's start with the low-hanging fruit. It isn't possible to reduce an entire university to a single number, at least not without losing all meaning in the process. In what world does Goshen College, a Mennonite school with 827 students in rural Indiana, belong on the same list as a party school like, say, the University of Alabama, whose student population is larger than the entire town of Goshen? In fairness, they do share the same basic mission, the proliferation of knowledge, but the same can't be said of all schools. The Mennonites look like close relatives of Crimson Tide when compared to Peking University, whose charter replaced freedom of thought with loyalty to the Communist Party in 2019. One building strives to cultivate the next generation of thinkers, the other to churn out obedient workers. Yet the big three international rankings, QS, ARWU, and The Times, don't even acknowledge the fact that entire fields of study are forbidden at some universities. But okay, enough with all the high-minded philosophy. At the end of the day, people like to rank things, and there is an undeniable difference between your local community college and MIT. Assuming that schools can be reduced to a single number, what specific criteria should be used? You might suggest student satisfaction, teaching quality, graduate employment rate, or, how could you forget, the cost of tuition. Wrong, 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 and LOL. What rankings do consider is the proportion of international students, which brings us to the positive feedback loop. Each new international student increases their school's ratio, which in turn boosts its overall ranking. Meanwhile, how do international students choose schools? That's right, rankings. Around and around and around. At some point, to reject international students is to willfully forego prestige, and therefore revenue. This irresistible, self-perpetuating cycle encourages schools to admit students even with an inadequate grasp of English, setting them up to fail. Schools that pursue this strategy tend to have very large Chinese student populations, which often results in social bubbles on campus. After 4 years, they may graduate with few, if any, local friends, despite coming, in large part, for that exposure. Now, to put things in perspective, the international student ratio only comprises 5% of the QS ranking formula. But make no mistake, their actual contribution is many times larger. Few Americans pay the price of tuition shown on Google. Those who attend college in their own state pay only about half the sticker price, and even out-of-state tuition is offset by financial aid. About the only students who do pay full price are international students. And on top of that, they pay additional fees, disproportionately live in student dorms, and buy university meal plans. With all that extra cash, schools can buy their way up the rankings, attracting even more students, and so on. In 2008, Baylor offered new students $1,000 a year in student aid to retake their SATs and score an extra 50 points, artificially boosting its numbers. QS even offers a paid consulting service in a clear conflict of interest. In the best case, this extra cash is spent hiring more teachers, increasing its teacher-to-student ratio, which comprises 20% of the QS formula, and attracting researchers who boost the school's academic citations, another 20%. Now, you might argue that's how things are supposed to work. Money affords quality, the rich get richer, no surprise there, and there's no reason schools should all be equal. But what does quality really mean? Teacher-to-student ratios tell you how small a school's classes are, but not how good the teaching. Students may wonder why so many of their classes are capped at 19 or 20 students. The reason is that US News counts the number of classes with 20 or fewer. The result is that access to the best professors is restricted. In a world with an infinite number of great teachers, smaller class sizes would always be better. But as anyone who's attended college can tell you, that's definitely not the case. Citations per faculty is an even worse proxy for quality. The number of academic publications a school produces has almost nothing to do with the undergraduate experience. In fact, more time spent on research equals less emphasis on teaching. When folks reminisce about college, they mention things like the fun social environment and maybe one or two standout classes. What they don't tend to remember is their school's number of academic citations. Silly as this sounds, millions of students inadvertently choose schools based on this very criteria. Yet just 2% of admissions directors think ranking systems are, quote, very effective at helping students find the right school. All they really do is reward those willing to play the game, like Singapore's NTU, who made massive leaps in the ranking thanks to a sudden, coordinated burst of research. That's, of course, assuming the research being cited is even good. You can probably think of a widely cited paper linking vaccines to a certain neurological disorder. Now, you might counter that students are just holding it wrong, misunderstanding what rankings actually measure. Research. But they aren't even good at measuring that. A full 50% of the QS formula is reputation. How does a school gain a reputation? In no small part, rankings. In other words, rankings measure reputation, and reputations are determined by ranking. Professor Emmanuel Ordorica calls rankings Harvardometers, suggesting they merely measure how close a school is to what we already assume to be the best. Any formula that didn't place Harvard near the top would have to go back to the drawing board until it did. Still, somehow it gets worse. Way worse. The way reputation is measured is, in part, with online surveys in which respondents are rewarded with free swag. US News has college presidents rate hundreds of their competitors on a scale of 1 to 5. In one study, Princeton's business school was ranked in the top 10 despite not even existing. Meanwhile, according to researchers, rankings aren't even precise enough to accurately distinguish between 1st and 10th place. The problem is that we act as though they can. In one egregious case, administrators of the University of Malaya were fired after it suddenly dropped 80 places in the Times ranking due only to a change in definition. So why not group schools together to at least avoid giving the false impression of precision? Because this volatility is a core part of the rankings business model. It produces an annual round of drama and publicity. Wow, this school dropped 10 places, and this one gained 5, when nothing effectively changed as far as students are concerned. So, colleges can't be reduced to a single number. Even if they could, this isn't how you do it. And even if it were, you wouldn't add all these different metrics together, producing a result that neither accurately measures reputation, quality, or research. But remember, rankings are not just a corporate parasite one can ignore. Imagine if Consumer Reports had a total monopoly on public information about phones, TVs, or cars. Apple and Toyota would design their products not based on what we actually want, but whatever arbitrary metrics profit-seeking Consumer Reports decides on. We've talked about schools that benefit from this system, but for every Harvard, NTU, and Princeton, a dozen more are held totally captive against their will. Ranking companies enforce compliance with a threat. Either hand over the data we demand, or your rankings will suffer. That's no exaggeration. US News, for instance, assigns schools who refuse to play the game below average scores. Ultimately, everyone suffers. Professors are incentivized to farm citations to keep their jobs, students are deceived, international students totally exploited, and administrators encouraged to cheat. Yet, we all actively play the game. Colleges whose very professors write papers eviscerating the methodology of rankings continue advertising their US News ranking on pamphlets. Even you watching this very video may intellectually believe rankings are pointless, but will surely close this window and continue acting otherwise. It's a kind of psychological pyramid scheme. Even if you don't believe in rankings, you'd be wise to act as though you do, because real or fake, they really do mean something to other people. To justify our crushing student loans, and because you'd be dumb not to advertise the good school you attended, we recruit others, perpetuating the belief that rankings mean anything. But things may be about to change. Remember, at the heart of all this were international students. Just a few short years ago, the rapid growth of Chinese students on US campuses produced a mix of both ugly racist anxiety and legitimate concerns about academic freedom. Schools had found a seemingly bottomless source of income. To them, it felt like an infinite money glitch. And when every cast of the line is even more fruitful than the last, even the most rational fishermen will struggle to restrain themselves. How could they deliberately leave all this free money on the table? And besides, if they don't catch these fish, someone else will. Thus, they continued to depend more and more on Chinese international students, even while aware of the risk of relying so heavily on one single market. Today, the concern is reversed. When national borders closed in the spring of 2020 and restrictions extended into summer, universities began wondering if they had just permanently lost a critical component of their revenue model. The decline in international students doesn't look catastrophic. That is, until you focus on the number of new international students. Existing students are likely to finish their degrees no matter what, and because the decision to take the SAT over the Gaokao, for instance, is made years in advance in China, schools still have a few years of runway left. Students who've already committed to this path. The concern is that, while most of the world will return to normal, the largest and most lucrative source of students, China, never will. Because, for them, COVID is only one in an already growing list of concerns about studying or even living abroad. The Chinese government increasingly portrays the world beyond its borders as a violent, unwelcoming, apocalyptic wasteland, seizing on every legitimately tragic crime in order to tell a larger story of state collapse. The number one criteria for choosing a school is not teaching quality, career prospects, or even cost of living. It's, by far, safety. And international students have never felt less safe in America. What does it mean for higher education that a central feature of their business, academic, and incentive structure may be permanently disrupted? That their largest source of revenue may suddenly be gone forever? How will they compensate when this wasteful, inefficient system also becomes financially insolvent? The truth is, no one yet knows. Not even they do. Some argue the university model is in decline and will soon be replaced with mass online education. But schools still have one giant advantage. Anything can be learned online, but only schools can offer accountability, structure, and guidance. That's also the premise behind Fabulous, today's sponsor. Fabulous is a habit-forming and tracking app backed by science. You don't need an app to meditate, get better sleep, or be more productive. But most of us, myself included, need motivation and accountability to do so consistently. You pick the healthy habits, and Fabulous will help you actually stick to them. What I like about the app is that it adjusts to you. They know that you'll resist anything that feels like homework. So instead, the app learns when and how to remind and motivate you. I used to run 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, but kinda accidentally took this last year or so off. I've been using Fabulous for over a month now and am back to exercising 3 times a week. Start building your ideal daily routine. The first 500 people who click the link on screen now or in the description will get 25% off Fabulous Premium.